Eat Geek Play Podcast, episode number 15, talking Daredevil and Kabuki with David Mack.
It's a strange day. The roses are in bloom, but in a strange way.
Welcome back to the Eat Geek Play podcast. My name is Kevin Knight. I am the editor-in-chief of eatgeekplay.com, the website where we talk geek almost every day of the week. So, unbeknownst to me, this ended up being Daredevil month here at eatgeekplay.com. Now, what I mean by that is the last podcast, I got to sit down with Mark Waid, the one and only Mark Waid, and we talked about Daredevil for a really long time and just everything the guy's got going on. It was a fun podcast, and I hope you downloaded it. If you didn't, go back and listen to it. I really enjoyed recording that one. So this week, I talked to another Daredevil writer, this time David Mack. David's responsible for the sci-fi Japanese noir book, Kabuki, which if you have not read, this should be in your library. It's a fantastic series, and that led David over to writing Daredevil right after Kevin Smith left the book. And he is actually responsible for bringing Brian Michael Bendis into Marvel Comics. You're going to hear that story in this podcast. It's really good. Guys, you want to stick around for this entire podcast. Now, it's a little longer, and I apologize, but we got on some really cool topics. And again, I got to apologize. We kind of ramble all over the place. You know, I never follow a script with these things. I just kind of let it go and have a regular conversation, just like you and I would. This time it just kind of rambled all over the place. It was early morning. I hadn't had enough coffee, or maybe I had too much. I'm just not sure. But it's a little disjointed at parts. And again, it's a little badly recorded because I'm still working in some new equipment. If you notice, I might sound a little bit better than normal. And that's because I got a new mixer. And I'm still getting the whole recording the Skype and everything down. But enough of those excuses. We got to pay some bills. As you know, this podcast is brought to you by the Long Beach Comic and Horror Convention, happening November 23rd and 24th at the Long Beach Convention Center in Long Beach, California. So we've got 9 days left. 9 days until this amazing convention opens its doors and welcomes you. Now, just like last week, I'm going to highlight one guest that's important that you need to go say hello, get an autograph, and say thank you. Marv Wolfman is one of the main reasons why I read comic books today. In 1984, Marv Wolfman and George Perez brought back the Teen Titans. At the time, Teen Titans was as big as Uncanny X-Men. Now, Marv wrote probably one of the best comic book stories you have or may have never read, called The Judas Contract. It's a storyline in Teen Titans that changed the face of comic books. Bold statement? Yes. The truth? Yes. It was the story that made every writer step up their game, and the book was also really responsible for inspiring a ton of writers and artists to get into the comic book field in the 80s. Sure, he created the Teen Titans, but he also wrote Tomb of Dracula, Daredevil, Thor, Fantastic Four, Amazing Spider-Man, Action Comics, Batman, Green Lantern, Omega Men, Vigilante, Nightwing. The list goes on and on and on. The man is a true legend in the comic book world. If you get a chance and you're just wandering around Long Beach Comic Con, you see this guy, say hello. Say thank you. Because without him, the comic book landscape will be very different right now. Okay, that's it. I'm off my soapbox. Long Beach Comic Con, November 23rd and 24th, happening at the Long Beach Convention Center in beautiful Long Beach, California. And guess what? We are going to be there as well. Eat Geek Play has the podcast lounge happening. For 2 days, I'm going to have a huge space where I'm going to be interviewing all the guests of the convention. We're going to have bands playing. This Wild Life, Cosby Sweater, Jedi Elvis, and Rocom are all going to be playing on the floor during the convention. And if you come in between 9:30 and 10 o'clock, I'm going to give you a bag chock full of free stuff. Almost $100 worth of free stuff in some of these bags. And you know what? I'm just going to hand it over to you. For the first time ever, I'm going to have Eat Geek Play t-shirts, and we're going to be printing them right there on the floor. Now, if that's not enough, you feel like you still need more, Chuck BB, Patrick Yarrick, Misha, and Rocom will all be at the booth doing free sketches. Can't make it out to the Long Beach Comic Con? That's okay. We're going to live stream all of the interviews. I think. Still working on that. Make sure you follow the Eat Geek Play Twitter and Facebook for all the information of what's going on during Long Beach Comic Con. So go over to longbeachcomiccon.com, get your tickets, $40, gets you a two-day pass, gets you in at 9:30 before everybody else at 10 o'clock. You want to be there just for the free stuff I'm going to hand you. Now, really quick, I want to let you guys know about a friend of mine's podcast. It's called 100 Words or Less, the podcast. Now, what it is it's my buddy Ray. He sits down and talks one-on-one with just his buddies, and a lot of them happen to be in bands. And, you know, this week he talks to Neil from Alexis on Fire. The week before that, he talked to Dennis from Refused. And the week before that, he talked to Davey Havoc. Now, let me tell you, this podcast, it has nothing to do with comic books, but it's just really fun. And Ray's been doing this for 80-some-odd episodes, and they're all just really good interviews because he puts a lot of heart and thought into it. And honestly, I bite a lot of my style from him, and I just wanted to give him props for it because I just hope that someday my podcast can be as cool as his. So with that being said, you can find his podcast at 100wordspodcast.com. That's 100wordspodcast.com. Go add it to your feed and say hello to Ray. He's a really good guy. Known him for years. Now, let's go to New York with David Mack. But enough about Singapore. I could talk for days, but...
Yeah.
So this has kind of turned into Daredevil month for the podcast. unbeknownst to me. The fact that, I am a huge Daredevil fan. I just had Mark Waid on, and then you, and then next week I have Palmiotti. So... It's the Daredevil trifecta, I guess. So if you don't mind, I'd like to talk about Daredevil with you for a little bit, and then we'll get into the life of David Mack. So I just finished reading Daredevil Into Days, and it was quite fascinating, I think, because. You know, they're Daredevil lore. There's always been so many different stories about it, but nobody's really told like that kind of, you know, what it would be like with the end of Daredevil. How did this whole thing come about? And, what was the process of it?
It started with Brian Bendis and I were talking. I was telling him about some different projects that Warren Simons, who was then an editor at Marvel, was pitching to me like different projects to write. You know, he was talking about me writing an Echo series and some other series that I was writing. And I was telling Brian this and getting his opinion and just discussing some of it with him. And he said, oh, you know what? There's something else Warren's been asking me to do. And it's kind of been on the back burner, but we should totally just write it together. And that way we'll actually make it happen. And I was like, oh, what's that? And he told me, yeah, it's the idea of like this last story of Daredevil. And it would be really fun to co-write it. And I said, well, yeah, that sounds amazing. And he goes, yeah, and it sounds like, you know, Warren wants to get Klaus and Bill Sienkiewicz, you know, attached or doing it, or maybe they were sort of loosely attached, or Warren had spoken with them about it. And we were, you know, we grew up, Brian and I grew up with Klaus Janson and Bill Sienkiewicz, the Miller Janson Daredevil era.
Oh, yeah.
And Miller Sienkiewicz on Love and War and Elektra, you know, 30 years ago. So we grew up with those guys, and they were always nice to us, and like we liked them. In fact, it's kind of a funny story because when Brian first, we were originally going to work with Bill on Brian's very first Daredevil project. Just backing up a moment. You mentioned Jimmy Palmiotti. My first work ever for Daredevil was when Joe Quesada and Jimmy Palmiotti were doing the art on Daredevil. And Joe asked me to come in as a writer in Daredevil after Kevin Smith. And so that was my first work for Marvel ever. I was as the writer in Daredevil, and I ended up doing covers on it with Joe and Jimmy as well. And we did this interesting process of the cover where I would send Joe layouts of covers, and he would kind of choose the one that he, you know, best reacted to. And he would do a pencil of it, and then Jimmy would ink it, and they would send it to me in a FedEx box, and then I would then paint on top of the original that,
oh my God, really?
That Jimmy had inked over Joe's original pencils. And then, you know, being the last stage, you know, there's a lot of pressure. I'm like, oh, I can't, you know, I gotta really make this sing and make this work. You know, this is the original piece. And then I would put it back in the FedEx box and send the original back to them. And it was, and Bendis and I had been, we'd been best friends since about 1993 when we met in Chicago. And he had been doing this crime comic called Torso. And so I was sending the FedEx books back, and I stuffed all like the first four issues of his crime comic Torso in the book. And so Joe called me the next day and, hey, what's this, you know, black and white comic called Torso? And I said, oh, it's my best friend, Brian Bendis, you know, that's his new crime comic. And then he basically said that, and by the way, at the time, Brian was writing and drawing all of his work. And the way I put it is that he said that his artwork wasn't appropriate for Marvel, but he had sort of used a little coarser language, but he really liked Brian's writing, and that we should, and he sort of asked me, like, is he a flake? Is he a weirdo? What's he like? I was like, no, you know, I've been best friends with him for years. He's a consummate professional, you know, really smart guy. And so we ended up all meeting together. And then he said, let's have you guys do a project together. And originally, and it ended up being Daredevil Wake Up, which also ties into Daredevil End of Days. And that was Bendis's first ever Marvel script. And before it was published, that script got him the offer to write Marvel's Ultimate Spider-Man, which I think came out first in print. But that was his first project. But before that, he said, what do you guys want to do? And we said, we want to do a Nick Fury Shield story together. And the idea was that we were going to co-write it, and Bill Sienkiewicz was going to do the art for it. And that was the project that we were first going to start with it, that before Daredevil Wake Up. And we met with Bill, and Bill was like totally on to do the art. And we both loved Jim Steranko. And Jim Steranko had kind of been a mentor to me since I started Kabuki. I met him in 1995. And he came up to my table and just said, hey, all my friends have been telling me I'm going to love this new series called Kabuki that's been coming out, and that it reminds them of my work and that I would find it interesting. And so here I am, you know, show me the book I've been hearing about, which was such a really interesting way for him to introduce himself. And so I gave him the books I had at the time, and maybe like four or five issues. And
so does he walk up to you and just be like, hi, I'm Jim Steranko?
No, I knew who he was. It was sort of an odd. It was kind of he's a big dog lover. I remember his exact first words to me, which sound like crazy words. He's a big like dog lover, and the woman. This is gonna sound nuts. This is 1995. I was probably like 21 years old at the time or something. But the woman sitting next to, I was at a table at this convention in Dallas. And the woman sitting next to me had her own table. She happened to be a Playboy Playmate, and she was signing, you know, the books you will bring to me. And I happened to be seeing this woman socially for like the last 6 months, and she was known to have a this is digressing. She was known to have a half wolf dog pet, and Jim Steranko knew about this. And he loves his dogs and goes for runs with his dogs every day. So he came up to her first, and he says, I heard you have this half wolf dog. And, you know, I just love, you know, wolves and dogs. And then he said, I heard that if you stare right into a wolf's eyes, he'll just tear your throat out. And then he looked right over at me. I turned to look at him when he said this. And then he looked right at me and he goes, and I heard if you look this guy in the eye, he'll tear your throat out too. That was his very first words to me. And then he came over and then shook my hand and introduced himself and said what I said before, and started talking Kabuki with me.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
It's a crazy Strike Ghost story.
We've got completely off of End of Days, but this is okay. We'll get back to it later.
So then Steranko, like he gave me his card, and he would call me at like night, like 2 a.m, and we would talk sort of like, you know, 2 or 3 hours at night to like 5 a.m. on a regular basis. And as like I'm a really, you know, young guy just starting first year in Kabuki, 21, 22 years old. And he would constantly tell me, we would talk storytelling, you know, all these things. I would ask him questions, ask him his advice. He would very, very much a mentor to me that entire year. And he would always ask, is there anything I can do for you? Let me know. And so he kept asking that one time. So I go, well, you know, I'm putting together this Kabuki volume. If you want to write the introduction for it, that would be amazing. And he did. He wrote the intro. And then he would still ask. And then so when I moved Kabuki at Image, I asked him if he would do a painting for a Kabuki variant cover for the first issue. And he did. He did this amazing Kabuki painting for it, this, you know, original Jim Steranko Kabuki. And so I had this relationship with him. So then when Brian and I were going to write Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. with Bill Sienkiewicz doing the art, we said, well, we can't do this without Jim Steranko's blessing. We've got to get Jim Steranko involved. And, you know, in the past, he's always been helpful to me. He wrote the introduction, did a Kabuki cover. We at least have to have him do Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. covers or a section in the book if he wants to. And we were kind of designing the story kind of like we did for Daredevil End of Days, where we thought, you know, here's this new stuff, but let's give like nods back to what inspired us when we were younger, you know, hence the Jim Steranko thing. And then we met with Jim in San Diego, and he seemed creatively interested. And we all had a great discussion, but at the time he had some kind of business wrinkle with Marvel that he needed to get ironed out before he could do anything. So it kind of and then the project kind of just didn't get traction. And so to more immediately work on something, that's when we did Daredevil Wake Up. So that's kind of like the early backstory of Daredevil End of Days. And so coming back to Daredevil and Ace, now Brian and I finally get to work with Bill Sienkiewicz. Like, we were all on board for that S.H.I.E.L.D. project before, and now we finally get to do this. And not only do we get to do it with Bill, but we get to do it with Klaus, and we get to build it kind of like we wanted to do with the Nick Fury Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. stories, where we have little sections and sequences where we can have different, you know, doing like the style of different Daredevil eras. And have nods to, you know, to previous creators and stuff, you know, such as Bill doing little sequences in his own style, or if there's a flashback to the Miller Jansen era, Klaus would pencil and ink those black and white flashbacks himself.
Nice.
And we had, you know, me and Brian and Alex Maleev and Bill and Klaus. So we're all guys who sort of represent different eras from Daredevil, you know, all working together. But, you know, when the art would change, it would always be in service of the story. That was kind of the premise from the start.
That had to be one of my favorite parts of that. I mean, just the fact that it's told from, you know, Ben Urich's side of everything was amazing. But then just being the hardcore Daredevil fan, seeing those throwbacks to your previous works on Daredevil and, you know, same thing with Alex and you know, how you guys were able to interwove that into the current, that, you know, the storyline was just amazing.
That was fun because you have Ben kind of going, he's like your straight man. He's sort of the most objective character that we could find in the Marvel universe, and especially in Daredevil's world, to do this, because he's interacting with so many people, including Daredevil, who are not objective at all. Even though we think often of them, of the heroes, as the objective characters, we thought, this is great. We have him going through all these interesting, extreme characters. But every time each of these characters recounts their story, if they choose to cooperate with Ben, we will then have whatever artist is most associated with that character tell the reenactment of that story. So it immediately takes you to that person's point of view. Like when he interviews Echo and Echo tells her story, you know, I do the art for those pages and those sequences. And I did it with Purple Man as well, because I did the Purple Man covers when I was doing the covers for Alias, and with the Timmy character from Wake Up, I would do his scenes as well. Anytime it was from his point of view, I would try to do it in the way that I use the artwork with him or the other characters. And the same with Bill Sienkiewicz, when, you know, it's Elektra, he'll do Elektra, etc. that was one of the fun things about it. And it takes you immediately back to that person's character and their time, but it also lets you know that you're not, it's not an unobjective story. Everybody kind of, each character kind of has like a different artwork and viewpoint of the world, you know, to sort of represent their different way of looking at reality.
With the story, how much of it was Bendis and how much of it was you on the writing aspect of it? I mean, how collaborative was it?
Well, that is really the fun magic of co-writing is I think each of us in the past, I think this was the right time for us to co-write.
I was going to say, because it doesn't seem like Bendis is much of a co-writer kind of guy. He's an all or nothing kind of writer.
Beginning, like early in our career, I think that's how it would have been for both of us. Like whenever I'm writing something, I agonize over every single detail, and it's hard to imagine, you know, letting someone else, you know, just what are they going to do to it? You know, if you're trying to control everything. But I think, you know, after working together and being friends for 20 years, and especially having you know, bodies of work that we both get to do whatever we want in the past with those projects, I think both of us are very much open to, when you're collaborating with someone, really letting them bring something to it. You know, Bendis works with so many artists. I think he very much is open to, you know, you can't let them be your art puppet, as he says. You got to let them do it the way that they see it and write for their strengths. So I think that having that much work kind of trains you to be open for that. And the magic of this is just in that first conversation on the phone, he would say something that would make me think of something I'd never think of if he didn't say it. And so then I'll say something based on that that will be a different direction than he was thinking, and then he'll build on that. And just from a conversation, we'll be like, okay, this conversation just between the two of us, I kind of just fleshed out what the whole outline of the story is. And so then we'll meet again and we'll go, okay, here, you know, here's the basic points of what happens and what do we want to accomplish. And just a conversation, just one person going, oh, that's a great idea. And then if that happened, then this would happen. And this person goes, well, if that happened, then this would have to happen. And that's kind of how the story would write itself. And so one time at Bendis's place, we were doing that. And then he was like, okay, well, I think that's the first issue, you know? Okay. So I'll go and I'll send you my script version of the first issue. And so the first issue, that was very much him getting back into Daredevil, which he hadn't done before. So he wanted to just barrel right into the first issue. So the majority of the first issue is still very similar to like his first version of it. And then after that, he was like, okay, here's the first one I did. Give me your notes. And then, you know, on the next ones, you do the heavy lifting. And so I would do what I would think is like a full script. Knowing that it's, you know, it's 80 or 90%, that like it's not like knowing I would polish it as much as I could think of, but knowing that is when Brian sees it, he's gonna tinker with it as well. And then so, he would come back with his notes about that, and I would come back with my notes. And usually, what happened is once the artists would send us the art for the script, then Brian would go back and tinker with the dialogue. And then send it to me. And then we'd sort of stay up all night, you know, discussing it and going back and forth. And most of the time what it was is when the art comes back for the artist doing it, we would just pare down the script so much. We would really eliminate most of the dialogue, because what Bill and Klaus would do would add such magic and dimension to it and character already. We didn't want to clutter it with too much dialogue.
This was almost a return to your classic Daredevil that you and, you know, Bendis kind of just set forth. Was it great to come back to this book?
It was wonderful to come back to it. We both grew up with the Miller Daredevil. So like when I first started writing Daredevil, that was my Daredevil, was the Miller Jansen era. And so And the other characters, you know, I mean, the other creators, what they had brought to it also, that was a really interesting thing. The first time I started writing Daredevil, I had this body of work with Kabuki already, but I had never written a character that I had not created myself. So with Kabuki, everything I do with it, you know, it's right, because I know the character and I'm the only creator doing it. But with Daredevil, it had really like a twofold challenge. You know, I wanted to be very true to the rich history that the character had and be respectful to what all of these legendary creators had brought to the character. And at the same time, you have to stand on those shoulders and push it forward and use that as building blocks and do something new with it. Because if you don't, if you're not doing something new with it that only you would do as a writer, then there's really no point in you doing it. So that's kind of the really fun twofold challenge when you're working with you know, Marvel Comics in general. You really have to approach it in the spirit of collaboration, even with the characters themselves and the history of the character. And so I think Brian and I both saw it that way, and we wanted to really give like nods to all of the different, really like a love letter to the mythos of the character, like where he came from, the different eras that we loved on it, you know, nods to, you know, all of the collaborators in the book and what they had contributed. But then ultimately you have to say, if this character continues, you know, as he has, you know, where does that take them? So that was kind of one of the really interesting themes for all of us, is that Daredevil has all of these extreme characters. And if they continue the cycle that they're in and don't change their worldview, at a certain point, they can only do that with success for a certain amount of their time. You know, Daredevil, by the time he's in his mid-40s to 50s, he's not going to be as sharp as he was earlier. So he has to start thinking, you know, about what, you know, he's always been a smart character, and he has to kind of think, you know, he has to be aware of, if I keep doing it, you know, where will it take me, and what, you know, what should come after me, and so on.
You were coming off of Kabuki, which was hugely successful independent book. Perfect timing for you. You get that call to write Daredevil, you know, after the fact that it's like, hey, so Kevin Smith's run's wrapping up. You want to do this? What was that like?
Oh, yeah, it was actually before Kevin Smith had ever started on it, actually. But
oh, really?
It was an incredible call. Yeah, like the backstory to that is, in 1995, I met Joe Quesada at the Heroes Convention in Charlotte, North Carolina. And he was really nice to me. And I gave him my first Kabuki graphic novel, the very first volume one, which is a volume one that I, the first Kabuki volume I did as my senior thesis in literature when I was in college. So I was writing it and drawing it and getting it published while I was in college the whole time. And then had it all collected by the time I graduated. And then I gave this collected volume to Joe and with my information. And then like a week later, he called me. He called my phone. And he didn't really know me. He only met me that one time. He called me and he said, I read this book and I really like it. And I really like your writing on it. And I would love to collaborate with you on a project sometime. You know, at the time he was doing Ash and he had Event Comics. And so he said, let's do a project at Event, or maybe you write an Ash story or something. And, you know, in the next couple of years, that none of that actually panned out, but we stayed in touch at, you know, more and more, and I would see him at conventions, and he was always very supportive of me and would call for, he would give me advice and so on. And then one day I got a call. This was right after I had taken Kabuki to Image Comics in October 1997, I started the fifth Kabuki volume at Image Comics. And it was going great. And that's when Steranko did the first issue cover to that story, and it was doing really well. And he called up and he goes, "Okay, nobody knows about this yet, so you can't tell anybody. But I'm going to be taking over some books at Marvel." And he didn't mention it by name, but this is what turned out to be Marvel Knights. And I believe they started with four core titles. And he said, "You know, Daredevil's going to be one of them. You know, I'm gonna draw that, and Kevin Smith's writing that." But we got a couple other ones to fill out. And his first offer, this is crazy, like out of the blue call to get, he goes, you know, if there's a Marvel comic character that you would like, you can have your own book. You can write it and draw it of that character if you want under a Marvel Knights title, which is amazing. It's just incredible, crazy offer, you know. And I was like, wow, I acknowledged how amazing it was. And I said, yeah, I want to do that for sure. The only problem is I just started this brand new Kabuki series at Image Comics. You know, one issue comes out every 2 months, and it takes me every bit of that 2 months to write, draw, paint, and letter each issue of Kabuki. So there's no way I could write and draw a monthly book on top of that, you know, just in full responsibility and disclosure. So he goes, yeah, okay, I understand. What about if you just write it? And I was like, yeah, count me in for that. And so then he called back. He goes, okay, here's what we do. What if you write Daredevil and I draw it and you take over the writing after Kevin Smith? And he said he had checked with Kevin about that, and Kevin was for it. And that's how that happened.
Amazing. Like, so issue 9 was your first issue.
Yeah.
There's those – I just remember reading that for the first time, you know, being a big Quesada fan, going, wait, there's elements to this that are so David Mack, and there's still, you know, elements of here that's Quesada. Were you guys actually collaborating on the art side of things too? Like, you know, there's a lot of the layout and stuff. Like, there's that scene where Matt's playing the piano and stuff. Yeah. And it's very much a David Mack layout.
Yeah, well, in the time when Joe was drawing that story, that was in the process when he had just become editor-in-chief of Marvel Comics, as well as being an editor on the Marvel Knights titles and doing the art for the titles. So he had a lot going on. And at one point he did say, if you want to send me layouts on stuff, you know, that'll just be a help as far as time. And in general, when I had written for other people in the past, I would usually send them layouts with the majority of the script, or at least parts of the script, because sometimes in the script it would be a little unconventional. And so I would just send layouts to an artist just to kind of make it clear to them any sort of unconventional, you know, if the script says, you know, the first panel is the shape of a puzzle piece and panel 2 is, you know, overlapping the first puzzle piece and so on, which it was quite a bit like that in the Daredevil story. I was very much trying to give a sense of, between Echo, Daredevil, and Kabuki, how each one of them saw the world in a different way and kind of an extreme way, and how each of them sensed the world and made sense of it in their current adult life and, you know, from their childhood formative experiences that kind of shaped them. And so I was trying to develop these three distinct, you know, points of view in the story of these strong characters. And I would put that into the script about the panel layout and so on. And so I would send Joe sometimes very detailed layouts with the idea that, you know, for him to do whatever he wanted, but just for it to clarify anything in the script visually. And he would take, whatever he related to from my layouts and marry that with his own dynamic sensibilities. And it was really cool for me to see, because this kind of hybrid storytelling art style, like the marriage of both of our graphic sensibilities, I felt would come out in every page. There was definitely aspects of my storytelling, but you couldn't mistake that that's, you know, it's the Joe dynamic storytelling coming out in each page as well.
What was it like finally leaving Daredevil for you?
I wrote 9 through 15, and then in the course of that, I'd introduced Brian to Joe and Marvel, and then issues 16 through 19 was Brian's very first story. Mm-hmm. And I did the art for that. And that was what became Daredevil Wake Up. It was a 4-issue thing. And that was actually technically, I guess, his first Marvel script. And I kept doing covers on it for a while, because they had another they had Bob Gale, who I think was already working on it, already turned in a script when they were putting Marvel Knights together and so on. So it was a Bob Gale story, and I kept doing covers for it there. And then after that, Maliv started on his art with Bendis. And then at a certain point, Joe had asked me to do an Echo limited series. And so I was writing and drawing that. And then at a certain point, he had me meet in his office at the Marvel offices in New York. And he said, you know, I know we were planning this as an Echo limited series, but I think we should just put it into the Daredevil series. You know, that way it'll be a reminder to our story where we introduced Echo, and it'll give, you know, Alex and Brian some time to catch up on their story. And he just as a publishing decision as editor-in-chief, he put the Echo story in there. So there's like a 5-issue Echo story in the Daredevil series. You know, and I went back and framed it with Daredevil, you know, to a degree, to sort of like flash back to my story with Joe, you know, as per his instructions.
I always wondered about that. It's like all of a sudden it was like, yeah, because that was like around like the 50s, 50th issues era.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it was, 50 to 51. So it was this really great, you know, crime story cliffhanger. And then if you're reading the Daredevil series, and if you're expecting that the next thing, there's this very different story from a character that had been introduced a little earlier. And so it was a little odd, you know, in retrospect, because the Echo story is very much its own animal. And if you kind of like just approach it as its own thing, you know, I think it's rewarding. But if you it doesn't have much Daredevil in the story. So if you're expecting complete Daredevil crime fighting, you know, it's a different story than that.
Back to In a Daze real quick.
Yeah.
Did you guys set out going, okay, so this is going to be kind of a Citizen Kane kind of a story? Was that how you guys set it off?
Yeah, I think we discussed Citizen Kane in either the first or very early conversation about the project, and that we would kind of use the Citizen Kane story as a template for it, and it'd be an opportunity to just, you know, go through every level of Daredevil character, you know, and the character itself, you know, define the character by the Daredevil-sized hole that he leaves, you know, in the story and with the other characters and in the Marvel universe.
Which, it's great how you guys kind of tie everything back into almost a where are they now, what if kind of situation, where you're able to bring in all these characters that have impacted Matt's life. Maybe fathered a few of their children.
Yeah.
Was it interesting to just be like, okay, so I'm going to make up this whole story about, you know, where these characters are now and not really pay attention to the rest of continuity?
No, we were totally one of the wonderful things about it was just thinking about like the history of the characters and the continuity of the characters. But because the story kind of takes place, I guess, you know, without precisely saying it, kind of roughly 10 years in the future, it was wonderful to think like, okay, this is a great opportunity to imagine where the Marvel Universe goes 10 years in the future from now, and where each of these characters will be, you know, based on their past continuity, where might they be in 10 years from now? That was kind of one of the joys of the project, was just creating that world, you know, who's the president, you know, who's running for president, what's the political, you know, tone of the Marvel Universe, how does New York feel, you know, there's the Daily Bugle is closing. You know, print media is just about basically dead. That was a really fun approach to all of it. You know, where are all these characters? You know, and when Ben is trying to get information, he kind of starts at the top. He starts with the heroes first. He tries to go to the Avengers. You know, they don't even talk to him. He's such a street level person, and because Daredevil's final years had been so extreme and politically incorrect, the majority of the heroes had distanced themselves from him as well. So it was interesting to see, you know, that kind of tone and interaction with the characters. And we let everybody kind of make their own decisions. We didn't want to hit anyone over the head with saying definitively one thing or another. We would just show information and let them piece it together and decide, in the same way that Ben Urich is. You know, he's kind of, in a way, he's an investigative reporter, but he's sort of a detective putting together these little bits of information kind of at the same pace that the reader's getting it. The reader and Ben are basically getting information at the same time. And we wanted the reader to we always would prefer to err on the side of leaving things a mystery rather than putting too much information in the story and, you know, let the reader make hypotheses just like the way Ben is. And, you know, and really there's only one time in the story where we wanted the reader to get ahead of Ben and show that even Ben had his own personal blind spots and lack of objectivity at a certain point. There's a certain point where I think the reader, you know, towards the middle or end of the story, where Ben is so close to something personal in his life, and he's searching for certain answers, that I think that we want the reader to get ahead of him a little bit and go, hey, maybe this is that new Daredevil, or maybe this, but Ben can't quite see it at that moment.
I threw out to Reddit that I was interviewing you, and I gave people the chance to ask questions. Okay, yeah. So A Freaking Bear says, what was your favorite Daredevil storyline to work on, whether it's covers or interiors? And then he says, moreover, I have to thank him entirely for signing a copy of the first appearance of Echo for me. It was a gift for my now fiance back when we started dating. It was her favorite character and very directly responsible for my ability to get her into comics around the time we first started dating. And he wants to know if there's any chance of you returning, doing another Echo story.
Man, I love those kind of stories that like some kind of work that you did has some kind of ripple effect where somebody connects to it to such a degree that they introduce it to somebody else and that person connects to it. And then those people get married, you know, that kind of story is amazing. So I thank him for that. I would love to do, I mean, it was really fun to bring Echo back, you know, in the story. And I would love to do another project with Echo in the future. You know, I've been asked to explore a couple projects about that with her. And yeah, I would love to do that. I'm really glad they connected to it that way. As far as my favorite, I mean, nothing takes the place of the very first time, you know, the very first time you get to write Daredevil. You know, I had never written a Marvel comic or worked for Marvel before, and I'd only written my own character. So that was such a great, interesting, odd, crazy experience.
That's got to be a little overwhelming. Like, hey, you know, you're going to do one of our main characters, which Daredevil was never really, you know, it's not like he's on the tip of everybody's tongue, but it's a character that's so ingrained in the comic book subculture, you know, and the fact that some people have seen him as, you know, just being, you know, a darker version of Spider-Man, but, you know, there's so much lore behind the Miller version of things and, you know, then the Kevin Smith aspects and even the Anna Sente era of Daredevil that, you know, it's one of those, like, you kind of have to prove yourself on it. You can't just be like, oh, I'm going to turn it into a Daredevil story.
Well, that's a good point. It was a really special character to me because when I was a child, that's probably what I read more than any other Marvel characters. Daredevil was kind of my introduction to comics, really, the Miller Jansen Daredevil. And I had such high esteem and respect for that that, of course, that's what I was looking at, like, you know, wow, I get to write this character. But the flip side of that is, you know, I have to be respectful to what has come before, and I have to do, like, I have to really, you know, do the best job I can possibly do on this because, you know, what an imprint Miller and Jansen had left on it before. You know, at the time I was writing it, like, the Kevin Smith stuff hadn't even come out. So, you know, I tried to work with them to sort of segue it from the Kevin, you know, have some nods to Kevin, you know, in the story. You know, at a certain point, but when I was first writing it, yeah, it was very much, you know, I had such high esteem for that Miller story because that's kind of what made me, you know, I was like really young when I started reading that. And that's kind of what got me interested in doing comics and where I first saw comics as an art form and all the things you could do as a storyteller, you know, for the comic series, you know, the comic medium and it got me so fascinated in it. You know, my first Miller Daredevil story was that Angel Dust story with the Punisher on the cover shooting Daredevil. That was my introduction really to comics. And well, I grew up without a TV or no comics or anything. And I happened to be at a friend's house and that book was just, I was like 9 years old and that book was sitting there and I picked it up, started reading it. And, you know, I had seen like the Super Friends or something. So, you know, people with letters on their chests and, you know, colorful outfits, but here's like a guy all dressed in red with like a devil with horns, and here's this other guy that has a skull in his chest, and he's murdering, you know, drug dealers. It was a pretty visceral experience, kind of outside my comfort zone as a 9 year old, and I felt it like it pulled me into the story in such a weird way. And then just by happenstance, a few years later, I was in a secondhand store called St. Vincent de Paul, and I, by sheer accident or coincidence or fate or something, saw the very next issue, you know, even though this is years later, the very next issue they had there at the store for cover price. And I picked it up, and now I was like 12 or 13, and I was at a place where I could process it better. And I could look through the book, and I could immediately see that there was an intelligence, a design behind the storytelling, and that these comic creators were using panel layout and shadow and lighting and close-ups and different frames to make me feel all those things. And suddenly it even became more about, I loved the story, but I was more fascinated by the art form of the story. And then from that, I started following the rest of the series, and I read this Miller Jansen interview where by Peter Sanderson in a book called The Daredevil Chronicles, and they talked about Will Eisner. So then I went, and you know, this is pre-internet, you know, this is the '80s. So then I went and ordered that Comics and Sequential art book through the mail. I just wrote the publisher and asked if I could buy it through the mail, and I did. And then I started following Will Eisner because Miller and Jansen, you know, recommended Eisner as a, you know, storyteller. And so, you know, it had all of that tied to it when I was asked to write it. But then, you know, also you go from that, from writing Daredevil with Joe Quesada doing it, to now I get to do a project with my best friend, you know, Bendis. And we had worked together for years, or like on stuff I'm not even going to tell anybody to look for. You know, like starting in 1993, we started working together on a bunch of things. At the time, Bendis was trying to make a living as a penciler, and he had me as his inker. And we were doing penciling and inking projects just to pay the bills on different comic books. We did like a Cthulhu story from H.P. Lovecraft and all kinds of crazy odds and ends. And finally, we got to do a project that was like we felt was worthy of our friendship. We get to pour everything personal into this. And, you know, we sort of like learned together. Like in my formative years, he's a little maybe like 5 or 6 years older than me. So when I first met him, he took me to his house and he was just so excited to talk to somebody else who was into, you know, all the storytelling the way he was. And he showed me all these laser discs of his favorite films and talked about the storytelling of it and, you know, what went into the lighting and story, you know, the framing and all these things, and, you know, introduced me to this, this cinema scope of storytelling that he applied into his stories. And, you know, he was probably the guy who introduced me into David Mamet and David Mamet plays and books and so on, which I further studied in theater in college after that. So there was all this stuff that we had like been, you know, and this is pre-internet, so every time we would each do pages, we each had fax machines, and he would send like my new Kabuki page in a fax to him, and he would send his new, you know, Goldfish or Jinx or Fire page from the stories he was doing, and we'd fax them to each other, and then like give each other advice, and so there was all of this like learning from each other, and then finally, you know, we get to, you know, I send his comic in the thing in the FedEx. And now we are given the go ahead to and hired to do a project that we get to work on together, and so that was like that felt like a wonderful success as well, and like a crazy opportunity, you know, to like work with your best friend and tell the story, and then, you know, like each story is kind of special in that way. And then when we're doing Daredevil End of Days, every day we were just in amazement that, you know, Brian and I get to write a story with Bill Sienkiewicz and Klaus Janson, you know, guys that we learned from and who were operating at their A game still 30 years later after we started reading their work. They're still like so passionate about it. And Klaus was like so into the story. He told us that this is the project he's most proud of in his entire career.
Wow.
He enjoyed this the most, and like to be able to work with a creator that was influential to us and have them approach it with that kind of seriousness, you know, was, and he would send us emails or I would meet with him for dinner with Steve Wacker, the editor. And, he would show me his art pages and he would say, okay, you know, you have this many panels in the script, but what if I add this panel or what if I change this? And we were like, and we love that kind of collaboration with them. And we were like, that's great. You know, Bill, Klaus, everything we learned from you guys. So do whatever you want to do. You know?
You're like, I think I'll let you drive this one. I'm just going to sit in the back seat.
Yeah. I mean, they were both so respectful about like approaching it that way. And so open as creators about, you know, riffing on things. But it, like every page in the book is fully realized by the input of all the creators involved. That was one of the wonderful things about it. Like it couldn't have come out that way, you know, minus anybody on the project. You know, the coloring, Matt Hollingsworth coloring was just, you know, fantastic.
Hollingsworth is a beast.
The funny thing, even though it's kind of a joke, I think a lot of people know like how long it took for this book to finally come out. I think we announced it in like 2006 or 2007, something like that. And we had the majority of the book written in 2007. But then it kind of, you know, there's so many people involved. There's such a logistics, you know, to getting it with everybody's busy schedules. And so it's funny that, you know, it finally ended up coming out in 2012, you know, which, you know, might have been the end of days, you know, as far as we knew at the time. It seemed appropriate. But it was like 6 years in the making. And at one point, Ryan was like, I kind of like that. He goes, it's fine with me. That's been years. That way I get extra years that I still get to say we're doing a project with Bill Sienkiewicz and Klaus Janson.
So I have another question from Reddit. This one comes from NCOD. It says, first, David Mack, I met you at the Detroit Comic Con a couple years ago, and even though I was a penniless teenager, you gave me a signed couple copies of Kabuki for me. All-time favorite comic book artist before and after that event. Now, on to my question. One of the coolest parts of your artwork is that you use watercolor. What artist influences do you have that also works in watercolor? Also, was there any internal fighting about the use of watercolor at Marvel? It seems like a big departure from the most of the medium. Okay, that's two questions, but hey, why not?
I'll start by the last thing you said, since it's fresh, about any difficulty at Marvel. I don't know if I could speak for the present time exactly how it works, but at the time when I started working at Marvel, I got the impression that, I mean, I felt like a lot of artists sort of wondered if maybe they have to do something in a kind of a house style and they have to kind of make it look like what everyone else is doing in order to be hired. But the impression I got from what editorial was looking for, I got the impression it was just the opposite. I got the impression that people were looking for people who were different than other people and were contributing something new and interesting. And I came up through Marvel Knights, so maybe that's why it was that way. But all of my experience at the time was, they gave me incredible freedom to write or do the stories however I wanted to do it. And anytime they did have notes, you know, Joe Quesada and Nancy DeKeesian, my editor also on those books, anytime they would give me notes, they were always good notes. You know, they were always like, okay, you know, they would say, you know, what about this or what about that? And be like, oh, great, thanks for saying that. I'll use that, in the story, and that's a really good idea. And just, you know, it's always good to have some kind of feedback and objectivity about what you're doing. But 99% of the time, they all reacted very well to it. And I got the impression that I had been asked to do the work because they felt like my work was different than other things. But just in terms of, I guess, the subject of style specifically, I guess maybe it's because I started as a writer or always felt that I was primarily a writer. I felt like I start with the story first and I want to choose, you know, I'm going to write the story in whatever way I think the story is most powerfully told. You know what the story is, then you go, is this story best told in first person? Is it best told in third person? You know, what's the tone? What's the order of the story? I know what the actual chronological order is, but what's the best way to relate it? Is it told through, the main character himself, or is it told through the point of view of, you know, you think of all these things of in terms of writing, you know, what's the best word choice? What's the best rhythm, the line? So when the story is told visually, I ask all of those same questions about each story. What's the best visual way and most powerful visual way to communicate this particular story? And in fact, maybe it has a variety of different visual themes or ways or medias or styles in the story. Maybe it changes from scene to scene. So I ask all of those questions of myself. And if I'm doing the art for my own story, I will try to use the art in the service of the story and change it, or maybe develop a completely different look or use a different medium or change it from scene to scene. And I'll kind of do the layouts that way if I'm working with another artist as well. You want each scene to kind of have its own rhythm and feel, and so you can change the layouts accordingly. And that's one of the – that's sort of the fun of comics to me, is there's no reason to make – why would your comic look the way another comic looks if it's dealing with something different, you know, than another story? And even if it's the same character, if it's a different era for the character, or he's in a different, you know, context or light or emotional situation, or And probably the art style shifts or evolves based on the emotional arc of the character and of the story as well. So just the way, exactly the way you would do that if you're writing it, I felt like I should be conscious of doing that when I'm doing the art too. So like the very first Kabuki volume, it's kind of a crime noir. It's like a crime story set in Japan. So it's kind of a crime noir, black and white art style. And I felt like using the black and white art style was like it was a really particular choice that best told that particular story. And so, but that gave me the opportunity in the following story to contrast it by starting that story with, you know, mixed media and watercolor and collage and, you know, all this color story that's kind of framed from the beginning and end of a black and white story. And, you know, contrast is everything. That's kind of the fun project of it for me. And I don't know if a lot of people know this, but the interesting thing was when I began Kabuki, I had no interest in doing the art for it. I had been writing this story through college.
Really?
And yeah, I was doing it for my writing class, my senior thesis in literature, and I had been looking for an artist to draw it for a long time because I was so young, you know, I was like 20 years old when I started working on Kabuki, and I had this personal story that I kept writing and rewriting, and I was searching for different artists that, you know, artists that I felt like were more talented than me, were more skilled than me, more experienced than I was to tell the story. And there were a few like really interesting artists that would do like, you know, Kabuki art for me and pages that, and for one reason or another, some of them didn't work out, even though like I felt like their art was great. And when I first met Brian, he was getting work as a penciler, and he was writing and drawing his own books, but the page rate work he would get to pay the bills outside of that was as an artist. And so, and his story is when he first met me, he showed me one of his crime comics, and he had like a very different inking style, like a very different, very linear kind of lots of scratchy ink lines for his art style. And I said, well, you know, maybe you should use like a different art style for this and use, you know, more. And his story is that I actually started drawing exactly on the, he had like this little Kinko's made, you know, mock-up of a comic. And he tells me I actually started inking right over his inks and that kind of changed his inking style and made it, you know, the more black and white crime noir inking style. And then, and from that, he had an agent at the time and he got me hired as his kind of inker. And so once we were working that way, I was like, well, hey, I've got this story called Kabuki that I'm working on. And the plan was for him to do the art on it. Brian was going to be the penciler on Kabuki. This is circa 1993. So I still have to this day these wonderful original art pieces that Brian Michael Bendis did of different Kabuki pages. And you know, he sent me like he sent in the mail or FedEx or something like all these great, you know, Kabuki art shots that he did on board as kind of like his, you know, imagining the vision of how he would draw the Kabuki story and scene. So amazing. I still have these, my prized possessions.
Please tell me we'll see those someday.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll put the, you know, next year is the 20th anniversary of the publishing of Kabuki. So I'm going to do a lot of special things for that. I want to, you know, release some special formats and do some special things. And so I'll probably include those early Brian Michael Bendis Kabuki artworks as well. But it, you know, and that was the plan. And then one night I thought like, well, I'll just do like an 8-page story that I draw myself just to see how it would come out. And so in the middle of the night, I just started doing it and I kind of liked it. And I was like, I'll do like another 8-page little story. And it kind of gave me permission to not think of it as a big project, but just think of this little tiny scene that just for fun, I'll do the art for. And I kept doing all these little scenes, and then eventually I was like, I kind of like doing the art for it. And because I thought of myself as a writer, it gave me a liberty not to feel like I had to do any particular style that said like, oh, this is me and this is my marked style. But it gave me a liberty to change it from scene to scene in the story, and you know, also from volume to volume. So for every Kabuki volume, I try to have its own unique look, and it might be in a different media or try to cultivate a different, you know, style and pace that I think is right for that particular story. So I just, and that was what I was hired on Daredevil for. So I felt like I got to develop on my own, and which I advise to anybody, even if you're looking to get hired by Marvel or DC. I think for me, it was really important to be able to do my own thing in my own context and develop on my own with, you know, with my own character. So that time, that way, when someone asked me to do work for another character, they were asking me based on me doing it my own way. So I felt like that's what they hired me. I didn't feel like I had to conform into something when I started doing something else, you know, aside from the natural questions I would ask about that particular character, you know, in terms of writing that character.
So you had mentioned Kabuki. It's been 20 years. Does that just seem like just way too long ago that you woke up one day and it's like, oh my God, Kabuki's over, and I've got 20 years with this book behind me.
I had been doing Kabuki I felt, you know, when you're young, you feel like just a couple years is plenty of time, but I'd been doing it, you know, for I guess 3 or 4 years maybe before I started writing Daredevil. So I felt like everybody, I knew it wasn't everyone's cup of tea, but I felt like everybody, and I was very into independent comics as well as mainstream comics. And I guess I thought everybody kind of knew what was out there. And I felt like, even though I knew Kabuki wasn't everyone's cup of tea, I felt like everybody knew about it or what it was and were just reading it or not reading it based on their preference. And I was very happy with the readership that I'd cultivated in my regular readership of it. And I was able to make a living writing and drawing Kabuki or writing it with other artists doing it. And I really enjoyed that. And I would have been happy just doing nothing but that at that time. But it was interesting when I started doing Daredevil at Marvel, like suddenly overnight, it was like I existed to all this entire universe of people, and they suddenly, you know, my previous work suddenly existed to them too. And so I every year I do get like brand new people who discovered it, especially, you know, if you keep your creator own project in print. You know, right now I have 7 volumes of Kabuki that, you know, they're in hardcover and paperback. And so every time you do a new volume, like the newest volume I did at Marvel, it's called The Alchemy, and Brian Bendis and I and Mike, together with Mike Oeming, who does Powers, we had brought Kabuki and Powers to Marvel, and we formed Icon at Marvel specifically to produce Kabuki and Powers there. And so even though that was the 7th volume, it was like the first volume to so many people there. Then they go back and find all the earlier volumes. So that was the interesting thing. Every time you do a new volume, it's like it's a whole new group and layer of readers that discover your work. You know, again, every time you do anything kind of new, it's this opportunity or access point for brand new level of readers to find all of your previous work too.
Is there maybe a new Kabuki book?
Well, I don't want to give too much information just yet, but yeah, I'm lining some things up to make it a special year for the 20th anniversary. That said, you know, I love writing Kabuki, but every time I do a series, it's such a labor-intensive process, and it's such a personal story that it's so immersive that every time, like even the first volume, I had all this stuff scheduled, you know, planned to do after the first volume, and as soon as I finished the first volume, it was such a relief to complete it. It was such a cathartic experience that I felt like, okay, I thought I was going to do more volumes, but I could stop right here. This was great. You know, this is still a good punctuation point. But then, you know, some time goes by and I go, oh, well, you know, and I'm just fascinated by other ideas of exploring with the character. And, you know, I felt that way with The Alchemy too. At the last one I completed in Marvel, I felt like, oh, this would be a really good punctuation point for stopping the story right now. And, you know, I think I knew in my mind, like, I would still always think about it, want to do, like, explore even other characters and other aspects of the story or that character's next era. But that said, as much as I'll probably keep doing some stuff with Kabuki and adding to it, I've done so much of it that I have so many other ideas for creator-owned projects that I want to get some of those out too. So Brian Bendis and I haven't ever done a creator-owned project. So that's kind of, we've been discussing that's sort of like our next big project together, is that we'll do a brand new creator-owned series that we complete, you know, from, or we create from whole cloth together.
Wow. with me, you know, I've been following you since Kabuki, and you know, I started picking it up in the black and white days, and to see when you went to color, was like, wait, who is this guy, and what happened to the old David Matt?
Yeah,
because it was this whole introduction into this new kind of storytelling for you. Really, I know we've been talking forever, but how much of that was once you had a new palette almost to work with in that series, where it's like, hey, I can work with color now and do it. Was it, did you start thinking of even more differently as far as layout goes and what kind of collage elements you could bring in, because now you're working, you're able to do this book in color and like almost even a glossier format at that time?
Yeah. It's a totally, I noticed that. I should say this, like when I was in college, I graduated with a BFA in graphic design and a minor in literature. So in graphic design, I took all the graphic design courses, but I also had to take all the fine arts courses. So I was used to working in color. I did oil paintings and sculptures and, you know, a variety of things. So I was used to working in different forms, you know, outside of books. You know, I ended up doing like bookmaking and stuff like later in college too. But when I did that first Kabuki story, I just decided the story was better told in black and white. And so I kind of had to learn. It was even a departure to tell it in black and white to start with. I did have to shift different gears from my head to think in terms of, you know, black and, like, even when you watch a black and white film, it immediately abstracts the reality of the film, like in a cool way. That's what one thing I love about black and white. We live in a color world, so you're automatically in a surreal landscape once something is black and white. And it also has a timeless quality. Like this, the first Kabuki volume dealt with a couple different timelines, and I wanted it to feel like when you look at a black and white photograph, it's abstracted, first of all, because it's black and white. But it also has a sense of timelessness and a sense of period at the same time. It gives you a time frame, but it becomes this floating thing in eternity all at once. And I noticed that there are certain films and filmmakers that have used that to really good effect, like David Lynch in The Elephant Man, or Akira Kurosawa's Seven Samurai, or Schindler's List, or Raging Bull with Scorsese. These were all really good examples of, they took this reality, it felt real, but it also felt hyper-real and abstract, and it felt like a very specific time, but it felt like a time that would hold up, that you could look at 20 years later, and it would still feel real. And I wanted to do that approach for the first Kabuki volume, so I had to get my head around that, even to get to the black and white stage, and the amount of what I had to leave out. A lot of times black and white for me was like leaving out information to make the contrast more interesting. And you're right, when I went back to color, I trained myself so much for the black and white way of thinking. When I went back to color, there were things that worked differently. Like I noticed that, you know, I would draw all the pages and have them surrounding me. That's kind of how I worked. At that level of my life, I would pencil all of the pages first, before adding the ink to it or before adding the color once I started color. And I would just have them all laying around surrounding me, like set up against the wall, so I could kind of see how all the scenes work together and all the pages work together. And because a comic is you're opening it to see two pages at once, I never really think of one page on its own. I always think of the two pages at once, how one complements the other page. And I noticed that when I started adding color to it, often that one page next to the other page would start to cancel the other one out. Like maybe the color palette was too similar. And I would look around and see all these painted pages. I thought like, oh, okay, I finished this book. It's all painted. And I see them all, and I go, but it just doesn't – it looks fine on its own. But next to the page next to it, it doesn't look as good as I thought it should. So using that rationale, now that it's in color, I started taking that page and I started lining it up, setting it next to another page or another page or another page, and I discovered that some pages would make it look better. Some pages would make it look twice as better if it was next to that one. And so then I just started mixing all the order of all of the pages based on if one page made it look twice as good, I just had to put it next to that page. They just worked way better. And then I thought, okay, they look better this way, but this isn't the way the story goes. But is there a way to accommodate the rewriting this to accommodate that it is more interesting this way? And I found that there was. So I would go back with the writing and I would change the writing around. I would switch the order of scenes to accommodate like why the color worked. The color just works so much differently and unpredictably than it was when I would do it from black and white. The layout of the page wasn't that different from the finished page when it's in black and white.
Yeah.
But adding that dimension of color changed everything for me. So to change all the orders, I would rewrite it to make that order work. And I found that it actually made the story more interesting in the new order. I mean, it was almost like editing film. Like I felt like I had all the raw footage and now I really have to finesse it and move it around and the editing and the cutting. And I couldn't do it whole cloth. I usually had to add a new panel or take a panel away or add an extra page. That kind of stuff is where I found the real magic of it happened. And to this day, every day I've done a book that's in color, I always, once it's finished, have to change the order of some of the pages to make them work better.
One of the reasons why we got together is the fact that you have an art show coming up, which is a completely different side to David Mack. Barker and Dave McKean, correct?
Yeah. Clive Barker, Dave McKean, and myself all have original works in an exhibit together at Century Guild Gallery in Los Angeles. And it opens Saturday the 16th. I think it's like 7 to 10 p.m. is the opening. And, these are all interesting, unique, creators, the people I'm exhibiting with. And so I can't wait to see, what all is there, from Dave McKean and Clive Barker. And, interesting, both of them also happen to be, writers as well as visual storytellers.
I always have to ask, what have you been geeking out about lately? What have you been watching, reading, what has been your geek of choice as of late?
I follow Chuck Palahniuk. He released a new book. I love him as a writer, and he lives in Portland. And every time I go to Portland, I meet up with Chuck for like dinner or lunch or coffee and hear of his new adventures. In fact, you mentioned Reddit. Someone mentioned about Chuck being on Reddit about his new book and doing a Q&A, and I went to check it out, and he like gave me a shout out on it about Daredevil End of Days. Gave like a little shout out about it. The hardcover of it got number one on the New York Times bestsellers list. And so it was really cool that he gave like a little shout out about that on his Reddit thing and like mentioned me on it. And he does that without ever even telling me. So Palahniuk, Kent Williams is a painter and artist I love a lot. He did comics back in the 80s. I've been hanging out with him quite a bit. And he even on Daredevil End of Days, like the covers I would do for Daredevil End of Days, I would ask him for his advice about the process, of what I was working on. And, we've actually been talking about doing a collaboration on stuff, but he's a guy who's also very influential to me. Another really interesting guy who does so many different things, Dave McKean, who's in the art exhibit, with me, this weekend. So yeah, I've not been as up on all of the new comics coming out, but, I've been following Bendis's X-Men run, which was like really refreshing and fun.
Right? Oh my God.
Any of it before that. And so I'm really happy for him. Like even though he's been my friend for 20 years. Right? So I'm sure I'm biased, but I'm really not that biased because I don't really read everything on a regular basis, even all the stuff he does. But I love the fact that he has so many different – every time he writes a different project, he's got a different voice to it. He has such a unique voice to all new X-Men, which is completely different than the voice he has in his creator-owned book Scarlet or the voice he had when we were doing Alias. He's so prolific that it can be easy to discount how talented he is, and he's so funny – it can be kind of easy to discount forget how super intelligent and aware of the form he is.
Yeah. I'm a huge fan of Bendis and, have been since the Torso and Goldfish days. And, when he just, blew up out of Daredevil and started just kind of taking over Marvel, it was just like one great book after the other. And then, after you do a book for 5 years, things kind of get stale. And, when it was like, oh, well, I'm taking over X-Men, I was like, that's going to be out there. I'm not sure how that's going to work. You know,
he said that if he had done it earlier in his career, he doesn't think it would have worked as well. There was a point where we were supposed to co-write Ultimate X-Men together at one point.
Interesting.
But, you know, like, things come at different times for different reasons. You know, sometimes you're more mature creator for that particular, you know, characters or project at a different time. So I think things kind of work out that way. If you're here kind of like for the long game, you know, like the long haul, like, you don't have to do everything once, and then, you know, you can sort of like pace your, you know, your creative efforts through something. And I feel like he has just the right amount of children, and he's at just the right, you know, point where he can write like all these kids in X-Men, you know, and all these characters that have been around. And I love how he has like the young versions of them as children versus the older versions of them adults, and constantly contrasts and juxtaposes it. Very clever guy, and a guy who I was learning from the storytelling forum when we first met 20 years ago. And then last night on his Tumblr, on his Bendis Words and Pictures Tumblr, where he has a new book about writing that's coming out next year. And I contributed some stuff for the book as well as like Alex Bleeb and a whole bunch of other creators. He has like sort of give their viewpoints of it. But on his Tumblr, I picked up his Tumblr. He had about story. I ended up reading like Paul Schrader, Making of Taxi Driver, for like 3 hours last night, just about the art form of. He's so good at, you know, knowing who to learn from and who to read, like, other people's creative endeavors, and it's great. Oh, you know, speaking of geeking out, let me plug one other thing. I just opened the mail like two days ago to get this. There's a new book on Philip K. Dick that the publisher sent me in the mail. It's called A Life of Philip K. Dick, The Man Who Remembered the Future, written by Anthony Peake. And I remember earlier this year he had I had written an essay. I did a Philip K. Dick adaptation at Marvel called Electric Ant, and I had worked directly with Philip K. Dick's daughters, Issa and Laura, and the K. Dick estate. And this guy had read one of the essays I wrote that was in it was included in the new printing of Android's Dream of Electric Sheep, and he asked to include some that sort of thing in his book, and we discussed some stuff in email. And I haven't read the book yet, but I just got it in the mail, and it looks fascinating. You know, I've read other Philip K. Dick biographies, and flipping through it, it's something like that I can't wait to dive into and, you know, read about the writer themselves, what they're putting into it creatively, but also what they're going through at different stages in their lives, you know, and how their life and their art intersects. That's always fascinating to me.
Amazing. So, last thing, you will be at Long Beach Comic Con on November 23rd and 24th.
Yeah, I went to the smaller one just for like a day, and that was the first time. So this would be my first time at the larger one, at the big.
Gotcha. Looking forward to it?
Yeah, very much. I have a great time meeting readers at conventions and like hearing feedback, and you know, it's really interesting to hear how different people connect to the same material, but each one has like a different, very personal way of connecting to it. When I'm there, I'll have the Daredevil, the hardcovers at my table. I'll have prints. I'll have the new print that I did with Neil Gaiman. Thanks so much. And I'll have all kinds of goodies there. I'll have all the Kabuki books. I'll be happy to sign any books people pick up the table, or any of my books that they bring that they've read, with no limit. You can bring your whole Kabuki collection. I'll sign it for you.
That's awesome. Well, David, thank you so much for coming on, and I really appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, it was a delight.
So yeah, that was a little bit longer than our normal podcast, but hey, you know, David had a lot to say, and I just really felt like listening, and man, some great stories there. So if you happen to be in the Los Angeles area this weekend, November 16th, David Mack, Clive Barker, Dave McKean, all at the Century Guild in Culver City. All the info is in the show notes. So also, go over to iTunes, write a review, select some stars, give us some comments, leave some feedback. It all helps us, really, I promise. Also, if you want to suggest a guest, say hello, you can write me at kevin@eatgeekplay.com. You know, it's nice to know that I'm just not throwing this out into the ether, and you really enjoy this, let me know. All right. Until next time, let's talk geek next week.